Then the war came in 1939, and I don't know how the business survived during the war, but it did. And limited production, because everything was scarce, of course.
Of course, the management as well would have changed at this stage. You know, the older generation would have retired and the younger generation would have come
in. Yeah, but there was no particular point in time, I don't think, that, you know, that one group moved out and another. Probably individuals moved on, but all family members.
Yes.
That was...
It was the next generation.
The next generation of the same family.
Yeah.
With the same attitudes. Again, on the Jacob side, there was a strong Quaker influence. It would have been, though, people... And in those days, you know, one generation of a family didn't change that much from the last one and so on. So the culture, the basic attitude, the basic values and standards would have been... the families would have been very, very well off by Irish standards. It's interesting, in South County Dublin, if you were to drive out from Dublin towards Dunleary, you meet a number of major Catholic schools, St. Michael's in Ball's Bridge, one of the city's large Catholic secondary schools. It was George Jacob's home originally.
Oh, yes.
In fact, the original facade of the building is still there. The Holy Ghost Fathers purchased that, I think, the Jacob family around 1941. Further out, Willow Park, the preparatory school for Black Rock, I think was owned by the Bewleys. Yes, I think it was owned by the Bewleys. Gonzaga College on the far side was also owned by one of the families.
Yeah.
But I remember Peter Fahey, who was our driver, telling me, Peter was an elderly man when I knew him, but telling me that during the war years, every evening, Mr. Edward Bewley was the chairman of the company, would give him the invoices for that day.
Yeah.
And Peter would drive them out to Gonzaga, it was now Gonzaga, where the Bewley family had a home, so that in the event of a bombing, the factory being bombed by the Germans, as you know, there were some bombs landed in Dublin in 1941, I think it was. But at least the invoices would be protected. They'd know who owed them what for that day. But that was only a minor detail. I say, how this survived the war, it was quite challenging. But the next significant event happened after the war. And this was to be crucially important. After the war, we're talking about 1946, 47, 48, that period, everybody around Europe is obviously picking themselves up from years of war, and trade was starting again, and people, I'm sure, everywhere were... Remember that export customer we had in Hong Kong or Paris or Berlin? Is he still alive? Is he still there? We must send somebody out and talk to him, and can we get things going again, and so on. And this was happening right across Europe. Now, maybe less so in Ireland, because, of course, we didn't have this tradition of international trade, of exports, but people at Jacobs did. Now, we ran into, I say we still, but Jacobs ran into a major problem, which was the main ingredients we use, flour, the two-thirds of everything we use was flour, sugar. These products were still very scarce in Ireland, as they were in Britain. And it's interesting, the British said, look, exports must take priority. We must export. Even if it means our own people have less to eat, less flour, less sugar, whatever. You know, if you're a biscuit maker, yeah, you can get you have to get permits for everything. You can get an extra 1,000 tons or 10,000 or 100,000 tons, whatever, provided that you export it.
Yeah.
The Irish authorities said priority to the domestic market, our own people must be fed.
So they went the other way?
Yeah. And it was virtually impossible to export. It would have reflected, it wasn't so much even, I mean, I don't think there'd be any, there wouldn't have been any controversy about that decision here.
Even though it was political.
I say that because, you see, cast one's mind back, it's easier maybe for me, but the Britain had this tremendous tradition of exporting. Britain was a great trading nation.
Yes.
The British understood we have to export, we import. That's how we live. That's our, we've been at that for the previous century. We had no tradition. We, as a people, 5 million people, whatever we were 3 million at that stage. But we had no tradition of export, apart from biscuits and beer. And remember, we had got into this tariff-protected cocoon of we talked earlier about early chocolates or the textile companies
and the woolen mills,
the car assembly plants. All these firms were a product of protectionism, as we were to discover 20 years later when the tariffs came down. But therefore, we didn't think in those terms. I'm quite sure that if I was the managing director of Jacobs in 1948, I'd have been banging my head against a stone wall trying to persuade the authorities to change. They didn't. And as a result, I think in fact in 1948, the two companies came to an agreement. I depend on Gordon Lambert for this information because he was there at the time. He was there since about 1944. I remember him telling me, quite graphically, as he described it, of handing over the export ledgers to the Liverpool company. You hear of the records of the people we used to deal with and the trading terms and the prices charged and the credit. And
that was handing over the business.
Yeah, it was, yes, essentially, yes. Yes, it was. Because they, in Liverpool, were able to keep supplying, Dublin weren't. And remember, the people who would have made that decision in the biscuit factory would have had the same number of shares, presumably in Liverpool, as in Dublin. So, here now, you had a situation whereby W.R. Jacob in Dublin had a very large biscuit plant, still a very large plant, Bishop Street. Older people in Dublin will remember, many Dubliners will remember in their school days, going through the factory. There were guided tours. It was another novelty thing. I mean, that's very few other, apart from the brewery, I think very few other people do that kind of thing. Or very few other people's factories were suited to, you know, school children going through a biscuit factory must have been a wonderful experience, and getting marshmallows and club milks and so on. But this huge factory suddenly reduced substantially to the home, and I should perhaps clarify, home market meant Northern Ireland as well as the Republic. We ignore partition right from the start. We always treated the Northern Ireland as part of the home market. So here you had this once great business reduced now to very little, and dubious prospects for the future. The 50s were a very difficult time in Ireland. I know people think things are bad now. Things are very bad then. Immigration was huge. It was in 1956, I think, the population of the country dropped to its lowest ever level, 2.8 million or something. People left Ireland by the boatload. Things were very depressed internationally after the end of the Korean War, particularly. Commodity prices were on the floor. Yet Jacobs were trading quite profitably. There was no shortage of cash. There was no probably all the inputs, including wages, commodities, were all very cheap. And biscuits, biscuits were, they were a luxury. I can remember myself as a child, and my parents were reasonably well off, we would have had biscuits at Christmas.